You're listening to the Rescuer MBS podcast with hosts Laura McGladry and Marcel Rodriguez. For show notes and reference materials, visit www.anchor.fm/RescuerMBS. Rescuer MBS, know your limits, improve your performance. I'm speaking with author Peter Frick Wright, contributing editor and host of the Outside podcast. In our discussion, we will talk about an incident that we were both involved in that he details in his Science of Survival podcast, episode 24, He That Is Down Need Fear No Fall. If you haven't already heard this episode, I would highly encourage you to hear that before or after our discussion. There is going to be a link to that podcast in the show notes. Thank you for being here. I appreciate you coming today.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'd also like to thank you for your podcast. It was very fascinating for me to see things going on from the other side of a rescue, and also just to thank you for being that vulnerable and putting that out there, because I think it's really super important just for people to be able to see that type of thing coming through through your mindset as you go through step by step. I think that was just both a fascinating look at it, but also just a very brave and vulnerable look. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for the people who haven't yet heard your podcast and will immediately do so after they finish this one, could you maybe just give us an overview of what happened with you?
Sure. So if you haven't heard the story, what you need to know is that there's a canyon near where I live in Portland that I go down almost every year. This was the fourth year or maybe third year. It's been a while now that we were going down. And there's a spot. It's the second to last waterfall. You go around the second to last waterfall. And then to get back into the river, there's a spot where you jump from about 15, 20 feet up. The last several times I'd been down the river, you jump in there and swim to the next waterfall, and it's great. This time I jumped in, and I don't know if I jumped somewhere different, if a rock or a log had moved downstream, but the water was only a few feet or inches deep, and I broke my leg, broke my fibula. So it was just me, my brother-in-law, and then his brother, who were both from Germany. I was a patient in the worst spot that I could design or think of to be to break your leg. So I was between a 60-ish foot waterfall and a 40 foot waterfall in about a 100-yard stretch of flat. And over the course of 21 hours, there was a rescue attempt or rescue effort to get me from where I was back out to civilization. I ended up having to rappel the last waterfall and then crawl and swim downstream about another half mile or mile. At that point is where EMS was coming upstream, and then we connected, and then there was a major rescue effort to get me. You know, at that point we connected, but we were still at the bottom of a
1,300 foot from the trailhead.
Okay. Yeah. I was going to say 700 feet, no, but I was at the bottom. Yeah. So a significant canyon wall between me and the trail. And basically, you know, that was about, I want to say 7 or 8 hours in, maybe nine. And then it was another 11, 12, 13 hours to get of trying to get me up that cliff. And then I was eventually evacuated by helicopter.
Yeah, it was definitely, from the perspective of the rescuer, it was definitely an epic rescue. And I would echo that you were probably in the worst spot that we would ever want to have you to have to pull you out. But the thing that fascinated me in listening to that, and especially in the context of looking at it from the concept of stress injuries and psychological first aid, is that you just instinctively did so many things. As I just kind of went through as a list of saying these actions that you were taking as you went through that were the kind of things that we would hope that rescuers are doing to try to bring calm, bring grounding, bring hope, all of these things that we look at that really support really good psychological first aid to a subject. But you were kind of instinctively doing those on your own. The question that I had was, Where did that come from with you? What is it in your experience or in your past that led you down the path or that brought you to those actions? in what sounded like a very instinctive way.
Yeah. I mean, I think it sounds instinctive, but I, you know, for the last, at that point for 2 years, 3 years, maybe, I'd been reporting and doing survival stories for the podcast. So the things that I was experiencing, I had corollaries to in the shows that I had done. So I mean, you say instinctively, but for me, it was very conscious. Like I was thinking about interviews that I had done and places like people that I had talked to and what their decisions had been and what had worked or what hadn't worked. I'd read Deep Survival, the Lawrence Gonzalez book.
Sure.
And then, I mean, the other thing was that I knew almost as soon as it was happening that this was going to be a podcast episode or a magazine story. And so almost immediately I was thinking of it in terms of a narrative.
Sure.
In terms of, okay, this is, you know, here we have this inciting incident, this broken leg, and like, how do things progress from there?
Sure.
So yeah, I mean, I think it's really useful to think of what's happening in terms of a narrative, of thinking of like who you're going to talk to about this, what you're going through. It also, it like removes it a little bit from your immediate experience. And this can be both a good and a bad thing. Mm-hmm. Like in some ways, you're less present the more you're thinking about something in terms of how you're going to talk about it later. You know, just we talk about this in terms of Instagram or Facebook. Sure. You're like, you know, if you're constantly photographing something with your phone or recording something with your phone, you're not really there. You're not really experiencing something. But I think there's actually some advantages to that from a psychological, on a mental level.
Yeah. And I think, but what I got from your narrative of it was that you didn't, I mean, certainly the actions you're taking, it didn't sound like you checked out. I mean, yeah. As opposed to like that sounds like a very powerful mechanism of the narrative or kind of trying to, you know, it would be contextualizing it in a way that it's like you're almost trying to process it in, you know, in line rather than waiting until afterwards.
Yeah, totally.
So that's one of the things that I think is something that people may not fully appreciate, and what I think it's kind of brings out with your experience is that these are things that we have some kind of conscious control over. That, and I think you have these you know, great phrases in there where you say like, I made a really conscious decision not to lose it.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's the fact that we can do that, the fact that we have that sort of agency or that sort of control is you know, I think that's very powerful, and especially as we mostly look at this as how does this work with other people, but then when you flip that around to, you know, what happens when it's me that I'm the subject?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that thing of being able to consciously do that—that's a really, that's, I think that's a really super powerful message in all this.
So I think the thing that helped me the most, and this came into play once before in my life. I went to New Orleans after Katrina. And just sort of showed up, volunteered. I was working with other folks from my school, and we just shoveled people's stuff onto the curb, basically. Like we were mucking out homes, tearing down, you know, getting them down to the studs, and it was mentally quite difficult. Just seeing everybody's kind of lives completely upended. We never met the people whose houses we were working on. We didn't know where they were, if they had lived or died or if they'd been relocated. But you like got to see all their stuff. You found their poetry that was in the closet and, you know, stuff they hid in the walls and everything. And a lot of the other people in my group had trouble with that, like really serious. I mean, if you think through the people, several of them have had just issues since then. I came back from that experience and spent 2 weeks writing about it, just an article. I was trying to be a writer. I was still in college. And I just processed that very consciously, like turned it into a piece of written work. And, you know, I didn't have the same kind of trouble with that experience that some of my collaborators had. And so I kind of took the same approach on this. Like this was something that was incredibly destabilizing. It was life-changing, life-upending. And, you know, I knew I was going to make a podcast about it. I knew I was going to write about it. And so I just spent, like, I kind of gave myself extra time, really focused on it as a story. Like, you know, for one, it's important to me and it's personal, but two, like I kind of just carved out as much time as it needed to tell. And what I think is going on is like the mechanism of taking something that you remember viscerally inside and that you picture and turning that into a story that you tell, every time you tell that story, or every time that you transforms it in a way, like the story becomes, instead of this thing that happened to me, it becomes a story that I tell. And a story that you tell is not nearly as traumatic as something that happened to you. It just sort of neuters the experience in a way. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, if you take the teeth off of something, it's not going to haunt you as bad.
An interesting corollary to that is that as responders, we almost have the opposite, which is, one, a lot of times we just have to get to the next rescue. We have to move on. We have to keep functioning. And then we know that most of the time, these are stories we're never going to tell.
Yeah.
Either because of the circumstances or because the nature of them are just such that we don't want to share them with other people around us because we don't want to damage them, or there are situations where a lot of times, people don't want to model that vulnerability to each other, because we have this sort of archetype as a rescuer that we're, nothing bothers me and I can just shake all this stuff off. I think that lack of ability to process, like you had in that very, very specific way and kind of in a real analytical way, that can kind of work the other way. So I can really see where that would be something that could be really a powerful way of dealing with that. And especially, it sounds like you did it, pretty much right after that.
Yeah. I think I started writing as soon as the cast came off. So there was 6 weeks in there where I wasn't
not as they closed the helicopter door.
Yeah. I mean, I was writing in my head the whole time, like even as it was happening.
The in your narrative, as this kind of unfolds, there's some very specific sections of this. So, you have your pre-injury, you have your up to that point, you have your injury. You have this period where you're sitting, at the top of the waterfall and kind of thinking, okay, well, things are gonna get better. It should only be a couple of hours, helicopter should be coming. And then, at some point you kind of say, this isn't working. Mm-hmm. I need to kind of change this up a little bit. I need to do that. And so you make this pretty big decision that you're gonna rappel down the waterfall, your foot's pointing off in the wrong direction, and your partner is not terribly experienced in these things. And when you think back on that, and that sort of, making that decision where, you're kind of, it sounds like, as you talk about it, you're kind of going into this part where it's maybe getting a little dark, where you're like, this isn't playing out like it should be playing.
Yeah.
And then that point where you say, okay, you know what, I'm going to take this really specific action to make this situation better.
Mm.
And just if you have any thoughts on like where, how that went, that transition from that kind of being in a little bit of a, maybe starting to go down into the hole and then kind of coming up and taking this very specific action that was, by all means a pretty radical action for someone in your condition, but that, knowing that that's really going to move the ball forward on your rescue.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I talk about this in the piece a little bit, but I just got scared. I didn't want to spend the night on this little ledge rock platform thing that we were on, or, it's the bank, but it's a flat piece of rock. So I wanted to get out of there. I wanted to remove a barrier. There was a section from a book that I had read, sort of in service of all the sort of survival stories that I'd been working on. The book is The Evil Hours. It's kind of like memoir plus just sort of exploration of the various forms of PTSD and their treatments. And there was a section that I remembered that was basically explaining how survivors who had an active role in their rescue had much fewer symptoms of post-traumatic stress than people who were in a seemingly similar situation but had nothing they could do, or were, I think the example in the book is like, if someone is in an earthquake and they gather all their things and their little brother and get them out of there and rescue somebody, that person is probably on average going to be less traumatized than someone who the earthquake starts, a bookcase pins them to the ground, and they aren't hurt, but they're just stuck under a bookcase the whole time. And so I was truly thinking, like, what can I do that's going to give me some agency in this rescue, but isn't irresponsible? Mm-hmm. And I've had friends of mine tell me that they were, when they listen to the story, they're mad at me when I decide to rappel down the waterfall, because they know that's not what I, you know, air quotes, should do.
None of the rescuers would agree with that. I mean, we would all prefer you to rappel down the waterfall.
Yeah, well, because I was so hard to get to.
Because, it would have been, we probably wouldn't have even been able to attempt it until daylight.
Yeah.
Given, if you were up on the waterfall.
But conventional wisdom is like, you stay put, you wait for rescue, and yeah. I mean, sure.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, if I could do it all again, I would have started climbing, or sort of started crawling out as soon as I got hurt. And, you know, I know, I'm not lost. I know exactly where I am. I know exactly where I have to go. I would just have started going, sent people ahead of me, and then kept somebody with me the whole time. Anyway, that's what I would do again if I, you know, I didn't know how long it was going to be. I didn't know how hard it was going to be to get me out of the bottom of the canyon once I was there. But yeah, so I was looking for things that I could reasonably do to help myself, but without kind of making your job harder, making rescuers' job harder. And that was the kind of, you know, once it started to get dark, once I realized no one was going to be able to get there before dark, it became like the math just changed on whether or not to do the rappel.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you have this just beautiful phrasing on this where you know, you talk about how the line between you and civilization had just gotten thicker. Mm. And I think that the thing that just strikes me as so amazing about that statement is that is absolutely what we're trying to do from the minute we get to you until the minute, you know, you're safe somewhere else, is to try to thicken that line. And that's really a lot of what the psychological first aid is all about. And I think that concept of self-efficacy, one of the things that it's very easy especially in a very technical rescue like yours, to kind of just, you know, especially where the patient's relatively stable, to kind of turn them into cordwood and make it a logistical problem.
Yeah.
And because there is a very huge logistical problem, you know, when I think about that night, you know, we had five pitches of, you know, 300 plus feet each, and, you know, people up and down, you know, the slope all the way, you know, and coordinating things all over the place. But I think, you know, that thing of really looking, for us, it's really about, one of the things is to involve the subject in that rescue and to really give them meaningful tasks that they can do, even if it's seemingly minor things. But yeah, I think that's something a lot of people struggle with, because we practice all the skills of rescue and the things that we need to do from a technical perspective and from a technical medical perspective. And, you know, we have to really make sure that we don't let the human side of it fall by the wayside.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think that's a really, again, it's really interesting to see you applying that to yourself and being able to gain from that.
Yeah. Yeah. There was one, just a thought I had on the drive over here was like, you know, you told me you were going to be asking about just various things people would do. And, you know, I'm thinking about this kind of like self-efficacy thing there. The one, I don't have a whole lot of like complaints or changes or things that I think should have been done differently. But one thing that I think a lot of rescuers could do in most rescue situations is just, and could have done for me, is just ask me about the area. Like, if I'm here on purpose, either, you know, unless I'm just a complete yahoo, like, I know a little bit about the terrain. And I don't think we ever talked, I mean, maybe it's lost in a fentanyl haze. And this was totally, totally covered, but, I don't remember having a conversation about sort of what I thought the easiest escape route would be, or, you know, had I done this before, where were we going, you know,
sure,
how were we going to get out if we had been in charge of getting ourselves out? So that's just one thing, is like, if the person is there on purpose, they probably know, they may have different thoughts on where to go, you know, than you have as someone coming in and looking at a map. And I'm sure you practice these things, but it not only, you may get some actual information, but also it makes the person feel like they're contributing.
Sure.
Even if you say, okay, great, and then completely forget.
Well, and again, that's part of that whole self-efficacy, which is, you know, what we try to do is bring you onto the rescue team. So it's not like we're doing this to you or we're doing this for you. We're all doing this together.
Yeah.
And I think that is a really good one. I know we had talked about all sorts of different things about, you know, could we float you out or could we do different things, and, you know, looked at a lot of different possibilities. But I think that is, you know, as you say, a lot of times we get people who are very knowledgeable about an area, who are there for a reason and they know the way out.
Yeah.
sometimes we don't, but I think that's a real, again, one of those things that we have to really force ourselves to really bring that into, you know, into the entire rescue and understand that the subject is part of the rescue team. You know, they're not just the reason we're out there. With, you talk about when, you know, when you finally see the headlamps coming at you and you kind of have this big flood of emotion and this thankfulness and relief and this ability where now you can say, okay, I'm allowed to be scared because you know, it's kind of coming to an end, you think?
Yeah, at that point. Yeah. I was like, great, I'm going to get out of here
hold my beer. In that time where, you know, you made that first contact and then as it kind of went through, you know, what were the things that as you kind of had that phase shift from all you to now knowing that there's 30 plus people all involved in this thing, kind of all working to get you out, what were the kind of things that happened in that transition that you feel were helpful or that you feel settled you or maybe started to make that transition from all you to somebody else?
Yeah. Yeah, man, the specifics of that. So the initial contact was like this huge flood of relief. And then we had a 2 or 3 hour sort of waiting period right then where I got a jacket, like basic kind of like stuff to make me more comfortable. The paramedic did kind of an assessment of my leg and was mostly like, I remember this quote really well. He's just like, I don't think I'm going to touch it. It looks really good. Like, it's lined up. I'm just going to splint it where it is. Like, I don't need to take that shoe off.
This is after the, I think you had said it was pretty kind of pretty hideously articulated. And then, as you were moving in the water, it sort of snapped it back into place or ish into place.
No, it was perfect. I mean, river reset it and it was, nice. You know, right lined up. They didn't touch it at the hospital. They didn't touch it. Nice. The paramedic wasn't. Yeah, he made the totally right call not to sort of mess with it more. You know, we got comfortable, and I think like one of the biggest things was like expectation management. So it wasn't like there was a very, I mean, and Robert, I mean, you know him, I'm assuming. Sure. He's become a friend of mine ever since then. He did an incredible job and like won an award for this rescue. And he did this thing of both like giving me hope but also setting realistic expectations. So it was kind of like the example in my case was, there's a chance we'll get a helicopter right now and like we'll be out of here in an hour. And whether or not that was true, it was great to hear. Like it gave me this sort of, it moved the finish line much closer potentially. And he's like, but it's really hard to get a helicopter. And then he sort of outlined all of these different things, these reasons why it might not happen. So I was like, okay, the finish line is both, you know, an hour from now and indefinitely in the future. So I'm like both sort of buoyed and, you know, my expectations are maybe a little more realistic than if they said, you know, let's get you out of here. Like, get to the chopper. Here we go.
if only.
Yeah. Yeah. So that mentally was really, really helpful. And then, I mean, the other thing was just like, he and I just had a really good rapport almost from the start. Like, I kind of sheepishly told him that, like, I work for Outside Magazine. I'm, you know, like, he's like, oh, cool. I read that magazine or I have read that magazine. And we just started a conversation and the conversation just kept going. Every once in a while, we would sort of stop talking and he'd do a medical thing. The EMT that was with him was like very much taking his cue from him and like staying out of it. Like he sort of like let me and Robert sort of bond in this way. And he was there to support, but he wasn't like, we didn't bond in the same way because he was a little bit in the shadows, a little bit just sort of like watching, looking, helping where he could. And he kind of like let me establish this relationship with Robert, who was going to be the central rescuer.
Well, and that grounding is so important. I think the one of the things that I think a lot of times, you know, again, as we talked about, there's you know, we learn all the technical stuff, we learn all the medical stuff, you know, we learn our patient assessment systems, and those are all great for doing the task, but they don't make the connection. And in a lot of these things, just making that connection turns it from you know, from what could be someone's worst day into, you know, basically a slightly miserable camp out with your buddies.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. We always joke around is that, you know, one of the things we like to do first is, you know, start a big fire and get hot drinks going, because how bad can it be if you're drinking hot cocoa?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that goes to the, you know, the concept that one of the big things that we're trying to do is to kind of put a real definitive end to that phase of your, you know, of your incident, to kind of say, okay, yes, it was really terrible up to this point. Now we're with you. Now things are stable. You know, we're not done, but, you know, we're in a different phase now, and you're not alone.
Yeah.
And help us out in getting you out.
Yeah.
I think, you know, one of the things as you look, reflect back on this, because this was 2 years ago.
Yeah, almost exactly.
Almost 2 years ago. What positives did you take from it?
At the time, or do you mean over the last 2 years?
Yeah, now if you look back on it, I mean, it sounds like one of the things that, you know, there was a really great phrase that you used in one of the things where you said, you know, this is going to be really painful, but I have the ability to suffer.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that it sounded like through this and subsequently in talking with you is, you know, if we're kind of looking at it in like a medical context where we have the pain scale of, you know, zero is no pain and 10 is the worst pain you ever have. And it's like, you know, if you're dealing with someone who hasn't really had very much pain in their life, you know, everything's a 10. If you deal with someone who's had chronic pain or had some big things go wrong, their 10 on that scale is a lot different. Oftentimes something like this will recalibrate somebody's, you know, call it their suffer scale or their pain scale and say, I've been through worse, you know, you know what I mean? Like,
Okay. So the things that have improved since this accident, I don't know that I'd necessarily agree with it, but my wife says that we wouldn't have gotten married if not for this accident. And maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. She, you know, I was not in no rush when this happened. And then, you know, we got married like a year, I guess 9 months, 10 months after that. I think that's a result of sort of reshaping kind of how I look at the world a little bit. I think that I was living in a little bit more of like, you know, I was 32 years old. I was living sort of like I was 25. Ish, even if, you know, we owned a house and like I had a job and everything, but I think mentally I was looking at my life as if it was going to go on forever and nothing ever had to change, and the things that I valued right then were going to be the things that I valued for my entire life. That changed over the course of those 21 hours and, you know, the surgeries and recovery and being housebound for 6 weeks and just not being able to use my body. Like, physically, I feel like I aged 10 years in one incident, where before that I was pretty athletic and running and felt good most of the time. And now, like, if something hurts, it pretty much hurts and never changes. So it kind of, like, but what that does is it sort of sharpens your focus on how you spend your time and the things that you want to be doing and the things that you feel are important. I took an assignment, a magazine assignment the next year that was going to just get me out of we were still technically in the country, but off into some exotic place just so I could go do that and appreciate that, yes, I had regained the ability to go climb a mountain somewhere and be there. And like, that story was great for a bunch of reasons, but the trip itself was affirming, and like every little benchmark that I hit in my recovery was suddenly this like big affirming piece of progress that felt really good, even if overall I was much farther behind where I wanted to be and where I was before the accident. I started to get practice at appreciating the things that I never would have appreciated before. Physically, I started working on all the little aches and pains that just sort of crop up and crop up from, you know, favoring one leg. And, you know, I've made some progress there that I never thought I would make, just with chronic stuff from basketball and, you know, things that happen. And I think that I have sort of applied that idea to a lot of things, like the, you know, professionally and personally, like making time. I was always someone that sort of prioritize the story I was telling or the thing I was working on or the project, because I do, like, I value this stuff immensely, and I value the kind of connection that I have with people that listen to it or read it. I think I did start to value the people around me a little bit more and start to sort of consciously work on those relationships a little more than I had in the past. And I think that's, I mean, that's something that's very important, but it's not something that came naturally, or it's not something I'd been so focused for like 10 years on surviving in the industry that I'm in, because it's really hard, that I had forgotten sort of how to be just sort of alive in a person socially and interpersonally to some degree. That's a different story.
Yeah.
That's a longer thing.
I think sometimes people really underestimate how an event can change you both positively or negatively. And mm-hmm. sometimes the line between which direction that goes is very fine. And a lot of it comes down to how you're able to process it, and if you're able to process it. And maybe on that, you know, you talk about this concept when you're talking about kind of the after effects in your podcast about being stuck in the canyon.
Yeah.
And have you had any sort of thoughts about what it was that kept you stuck in the canyon? Was there like some particular aspect of it, or some particular phase of it, or something that you kind of say maybe that you're able to put your finger on?
You mean some aspect of it while I was there?
Yeah, well, just some aspect of the experience where that's the kind of the sticking point, or is it, or you know, as opposed to just the overall incident?
Yeah. So the feeling of vulnerability that I felt with my leg sticking off in the wrong direction is something that translates to a lot of different situations I would come to learn, like. Things that sort of put me back in the canyon are like where I find that I'm stuck in the canyon are times when I feel vulnerable in a similar way. And it doesn't have to be physical. It might be socially, like I'm feeling vulnerable and a little bit rickety or weak, like just in whatever social situation I'm in, professionally, or just kind of like with how, you know, my life is going. If there's something where I don't feel like I have control and I feel like the outcome might have long-term consequences, I can end up stuck back in the canyon. It'd be like smelling a smell that you smelled before, and all of a sudden you're right back into, you know, your mom's kitchen when you were a kid. Sure. Or something like that. But it's, you know, it's feeling the same kind of like disorientation, my leg's not pointing the right way, but in a emotional sense, that's what can get me.
When it's such a, I think it's such a, you know, clearly that experience, that very specific experience, is such a visceral sort of thing that you can put your finger on, whereas a lot of these other things are, you know, way more or way less solid, you know. But I can see where that connection that happens, where you just all of a sudden have this thing where you can say, that's exactly how I felt right then when I was in this situation, and then, you know, kind of being triggered by things like that.
Yeah. And so then it becomes a like practicing getting yourself out of the canyon and existing, you know, it lasts a couple hours generally, but existing there and saying like, I know I'm going to be okay. I feel this way now. It's going to end. And then just kind of, it's like, almost like I said, like, I know how to suffer. I can do this.
I've survived worse.
Yeah, I survived worse. Emotionally, I'm in this terrible place for a while, but like knowing that you're going to leave it and just sort of pretending. I mean, I think there's, if it's not so bad, you can kind of pretend and fake it till you make it and until you get out of there emotionally. But that's a stopgap. Like the actual like processing happens when you don't fake it.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah.
And if not, maybe the black hawk will come along and pluck you out.
What is the emotional black hawk? I think a dog is the emotional black hawk helicopter that comes and gets you if your dog comes and says hi.
Hopefully it's a lot less mess than a black hawk coming in.
Yeah.
I think that's one thing that people always, they always kind of go like, you know, we have this kind of double-edged sword with helicopters, is that, you know, we love when they come in because it makes our life so much better, but it's like, it's also like a hurricane, you know, coming in, and especially in something like a tight little canyon.
Oh, man. I mean, you guys are cutting down trees, like, like moving stuff around to make a just an area. And then actually one of the most painful things of this whole thing was the helicopter just got some stuff in my eye. Mm. You know, they told me not to look at it, not to open my eyes.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, you're gonna look at a helicopter the first time it comes down. But like, it took a long time to get that little piece of something out of my eye.
You know, one of the things that you talk about as well is that struck me was a lot of the, you know, the feelings and the when you looked at like the dreams you were having afterwards, mm-hmm. and things like that, that there seemed to be a lot based around guilt or feelings of guilt, and that, you know, whether that was guilt for putting the rescuers out or whether that was guilt for making Ellie go through this or have to go through this or your friends go through this. Any thoughts on that connection of kind of why that would be after, you know, what, you know, because you would think about the things that would naturally pop out are things like, you know, the terror or the feeling of vulnerability or the feeling of loss of agency.
Yeah.
So I just found that kind of interesting that seemed to be a theme running through as you described it.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that I ever would have described it as guilt. I mean, I think when you say that word, it's like appropriate, but I never would have categorized it that way. Thinking about trauma and just sort of like terrible things that happen and the responses we have that are not helpful or that are helpful but are maybe counterproductive afterwards or years afterwards. Like most of what trauma is, it's kind of like the immune system and like an allergic reaction. It's an overreaction to a threat. Your body thinks it's a threat, but it's not. And trauma I think of as kind of like an allergic reaction to a memory. You think you're going through this thing or like on some level you're physiologically responding in the same way because you're remembering it. And I think guilt is almost like part of that response or part of that reaction in that if something has happened, if you're injured and you need to be rescued or you're responding or you're seeing something, like it's very likely that you've made a mistake like I did, or that something didn't go as well as it could have, or that, you know, you're just like in a basic sense, like sorry that you're out there. Like you don't want to be in this situation. And I think that the, you know, all of these responses that we have that are counterproductive or traumatic, they're designed to keep you from doing it again, or they're designed to steer you differently or, you know, save your life if it does happen again. Your body's trying to learn and your mind's trying to learn, you know, the subconscious parts of it are trying to learn and trying to be ready if it happens again. And I think the guilt there is part of the process of keeping you from, keeping you from being that same person and almost spurring on some sort of self-reflection or consequence to what you are going through emotionally right now and what you're causing other people to go through. That feeling sticks with you so much better that I feel like it's something that you can't ignore. I mean, I don't remember the pain anymore. I don't remember a lot of the kind of waiting and the boredom and the fear. Like the fear is buried deep in there, but I do remember like when you talk about Ellie and like what I made her go through and how much I regret that is still present. And I think guilt is maybe just like a more durable emotion. Mm. And our body is trying to keep us from putting ourselves in this situation again so that we're survive and live and pass on our genes. So yeah, the guilt is part of that mechanism, I think.
So have you been back?
No. I have been invited back twice. Both times the surf was really good on the coast that day. So I went surfing instead.
Nice.
But I am going to go back. It's just like I feel like I need the right people with me. I mean, it's not a small thing. Like, yeah. It used to be this thing I would do on a whim, you know, on a random Saturday. I don't think I can pretend that it's the same kind of lark that it used to be. I have jumped off some things into water, deep water, that I've tested thoroughly before jumping, though. That was, those were big steps. I feel like that was a bigger part of it. That was definitely something that I really loved to do before the accident.
All right. Well, if you go back, let us know. We'll be on standby.
Yeah.
just to take pictures.
Yeah. We'll leave adequate signage where we went.
Excellent. Well, I thank you for talking with me today, and I really appreciate you sharing this stuff. I think it's really a very unique perspective to get. I think both the fact that you went through this, but also that you put so much thought into it, I think that really helps bring a lot of things, some clarity to them, and I think gives a lot of narrative to a lot of the things that we're trying to do that we think have some efficacy with patients and with the people that we're working with. And, you know, even though you were doing them yourself, in a lot of cases, I think that really echoes just the importance of not only us building up our own resilience for when we get into these situations, but also really hammers home the fact that we need to be doing this every time with every patient in these situations, just to kind of help with that processing and help with the, you know, help try to end that incident for that individual as quickly as possible so that the processing can start.
Yeah. My pleasure for sharing it. And thank you for being out there responding, going through an epic. I mean, I think one of the most meaningful things that I did afterwards was going to the search and rescue meeting, your monthly meeting, and just having the chance to say thank you to everybody in person was monumental and huge. And I'm sure it happens at a lot of meetings.
It actually never happens. You're probably one of 3 or 4 that have done it over the years in my 10 years.
Wow.
So yeah, it's actually kind of interesting as we, as rescuers, that's actually part of the, I think, which is actually part of the process for us that always leaves things undone, is most of the time we go out and we do these kind of big epic missions a lot of times, and then you disappear into the helicopter and we never see you again, or, you know, someone just goes home and we never hear from them again, or something like that. So I think that it's actually really rare for us to get that full circle. And even with relatively minor rescues, I mean, things like where there weren't big injuries, or it was just, we went and found somebody and walked them back, things like that, that process of closure for a lot of our people, we try to do it ourselves, where we'll talk about each rescue to just kind of say, for, you know, because people sometimes are only involved with one section of it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, just trying to bring that full circle and give them the story, but we really very rarely ever get the full circle from the subject coming back and just saying, hey, here's what happened with me, and thanks for being there. Something
like
that.
Yeah. Well, I will say, I mean, not to keep going,
sure,
since you already,
that's right.
But another like really big helpful thing that happened was connecting with Robert and Joe, the paramedic and the EMT, afterwards. I mean, I can't remember if I reached out to them or they reached out to me, but it was, you know, I was just starting to walk on my own again, off crutches and after surgery. And they're just like, hey, let's get a beer sometime. And we planned it out and found a time. And like, just that little connection and just rehashing the event with the people that were there was huge. I mean, they're, in terms of making sense of everything, especially having that opportunity to just talk with these people that I knew exactly what I was talking about and could remember the same things that I remembered was massive. So, I mean, I guess if there is a way, I mean, you have to feel it out with each rescue and who you're rescuing. But that, I mean, that was an incredible part of it. And I keep in touch with Robert, and we still talk about it and just kind of go through it.
Yeah. I think one of the things that we found that's real powerful is even when we're dealing with a lot of things on our own, it was when we get people together who've been through a shared experience. A lot of times one of the, you know, as we kind of talked about, one of the things that's very difficult is that oftentimes we can't share what's going on, because either the nature of it is such that we, you know, it's not something we want to share with our families and bring them into that sort of damage or potential for damage, or it's something that we just can't really talk about because we're just not there yet. And oftentimes when we get people together who've been through that shared experience, very little has to be said because they were there. Like you say, like, you can just, I'm sure with when you guys get together, you can just sit there and go, you know, you could just mention a couple of words or, you know, some kind of thing about, man, I'm, you know, glad I'm not lying in a sked, you know, whatever it is. And we know exactly what you mean, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, kind of like, yep, I get it, you know? And I think that is, that ability for a shared experience in a lot of these things is super powerful. And it's certainly something that I think we need to look at as far as how can we honor all the things that we have to about confidentiality and just giving people space to process in their own way, but also potentially making that available to say, hey, you know, we are available. I think there's also sometimes where a real difficult one for us is where we have families where we don't have we may not have the most positive outcome on a rescue. And I think that's one where there's probably potential for coming together, but I think it's one that scares a lot of rescuers just because, you know, we kind of are supposed to be viewed in a specific way and bring certain things to the table and have this be kind of invulnerable and strong and all these things. And I think most of us would react very emotionally in a situation like that. And I think that's something that I think that sort of is very difficult for a lot of people. And I think, but as healing as it might be, but I think that's one of those things where, again, I think it's really great feedback for us, but it's one of those things where operationalizing that, it takes some finesse, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a really happy outcome. I mean, yeah. All things considered.
Yeah. I mean, happy outcomes are great. We love happy outcomes, but unfortunately a lot of our business isn't happy outcomes.
Yeah.
And, you know, and in a lot of cases in those unhappy outcomes, we don't really have the answers because either we weren't there when it happened or there may be ongoing issues, you know, with law enforcement or that where we're just not at liberty to talk about them.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it all, you know, the processing of it all is very, is something that we're challenged with as a community. And I think as we've looked now more towards opening kind of a broad, you know, making a bigger tent and understanding that where stress injuries for first responders kind of ends and where psychological first aid begins is, you know, is way more of a Venn diagram than a, you know, kind of a hard line. You know, there's a big overlap there where, you know, are we taking care of each other? Are we taking care of ourselves? Or are we taking care of our subject? And it's all kind of, you know, I think it's much more holistic than we think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And having that, you know, and it goes well beyond the incident and well beyond just the people that are there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, shoot, for me, this is a story I tell. For you guys, it's a way of life.
Oh, we got some stories out of it too.
Sure. Sure.
I haven't had too many times where I've had to tie myself to a tree to not plunge down the mountain if I fell asleep, but they're pretty fun.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This has been the Rescuer MBS podcast. Please subscribe to receive new episodes and interviews as they come out. Contact us at rescuermbs@gmail.com. Rescuer MBS, know your limits, improve your performance.